Live from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper, you are Live from the Path.
I hope you're looking as pretty as I am. I can't hear anything out of my headphones because I didn't plug them in, and it's causing me audible confusion in my mind. I didn't really need to tell everybody that, but that's what's been happening. here's the deal. This is a clue on things to come. This is how the show goes. It's what it's going to be about. Now is a time to bail. You're only like 30 seconds committed. There's no reason you can't find something else to do in life. Go hug your wife and go to bed. Alternatively, you can hang out on the show. Here's what we got going on the show tonight. So, Dan, you sent over an article, and it was about this. What was it? The nine sins the church is okay with?
That we're okay, we're good, but there's certain sins we're just all right with.
We just don't have a problem about.
We're pretty hard on other ones, but if they're ones that we might be doing, we're like, yeah, that's all right. That's not so bad.
It doesn't seem like a big deal.
Jesus didn't care about that one.
Is making list one of them? Because I'm in.
Ooh, yes. That's number eight.
Shoot, man, I hope that's not on the list. All right, well, we'll take a quick spin through those, and we'll see. I don't know. We'll see if we agree with that list, if we feel like it actually represents something we got going on. Also, we have some Dear Live from the Past. Mike, any heads up on what's on the docket?
No, they're way too entertaining for me to list all of them, Ben. But they're going to be Cadillac. Top-notch all the way around. I haven't read them.
I don't know, the beginning of the show may not match the end of the show. Okay, all right, so there's a crescendo.
Yeah,
hang tight for the crescendo of the program.
It's a ramp.
Before we ruin it, big thanks to our sponsor, Bob Eisenhower with the Eisenhower Team. Go to EisenhowerTeam.com for all your home buying and selling needs. Maybe you're just thinking, I don't know whether I want to sell my house and you want to see what it's worth. Bob's your man. Or you think, I want to move from here. I hate my neighbors. And life would be better out somewhere else. Bob's your man. Yeah. He can buy or sell in a home. He's the guy to talk to. I don't know. That's who I deal with. It's who Mike deals with. He's just a great guy. And they do solid work. And they're really good at what they do. So go to EisenhowerTeam.com. You can find listings out there of what's currently for sale. And also just give them a buzz. You just want to chat and say whether you should even think about this any further. They know the house business. They're the guys to talk to. That's EisenhowerTeam.com. And you're looking for Bob Eisenhower. Or John, hey, oh man, those guys reminded me, we're supposed to set up a buffet.
Yeah.
We got to do that tonight before we leave. We got to figure out the next Live from the Path buffet.
Does it have to be a Chinese buffet?
No, it could be just a buffet.
Like a Ryan Steakhouse?
Yeah, or an OCB.
We might be able to class it up a little bit more than that, but yeah.
I don't know what you're saying about the Ryan Steakhouse.
I think I did just put classy and buffet together. So,
but my friend Ryan runs a right reputable... He assures me that the potato wedges are turned every hour.
I went to the OCB.
Okay.
One of my kids chose. We said you can go wherever you want to eat, and they're like, we're going to the Old Country Buffet. And here's why: I dig the Old Country Buffet because they have an unlimited chocolate milk dispenser, and ooh. I have not run into another buffet that had chocolate milk on tap. And I feel like that speaks to me on a deeper level.
Have you ever seen him refill the thing? It's like a giant bag. It's like a bag of milk, and they put it in there.
It's an udder. They just cut the udder off with the milk in it and deposit it in the machine.
Well, I'll never have it again.
when they describe it as wholesome milk, that's what it means. It's in udder coming out.
Well, we need a Brazilian steakhouse around here. Now, that's a buffet.
Oh, man. That's dangerous.
That's classy.
Dan and I ended up at a Brazilian steakhouse in Orlando, Florida, and I had no idea what we had gotten into, and they bring in... There's no prices on the menu. And I thought, I'm suspicious of this. But like everyone else seemed to be all right with it.
No price means don't worry about it.
Yeah.
They bring like shards of meat up to the table and they skin some of it off. And they don't ask you.
Oh, you heard about this.
Oh, holy cats.
Oh, baby.
I never would have wandered in this thing if I wasn't completely ignorant of it. It's not a place I would ever step in. But I was the wide-eyed dupe. Was just like, this is a pretty interesting restaurant. So we ate. And like the longer the meal is getting, the more and more I'm suspicious that there's no prices and that they seem to come with an unlimited amount of meat on a stick. And I thought, oh man, this is going to be bad. And I think my bill was $65 or something. Yikes. Like for me. And I
that
skipped
was without dessert.
I skipped dessert. Yeah.
Wait a minute, dessert is not included in the buffet. It's by the item.
Another $20 or so.
Oh, yikes, man. I thought, and it was, I felt really stupid because I thought like, at what point should I have caught on? And they had a valet up at the front, and somebody, I just ignored it. Like, yeah, idiot man, I'm just walking in. Like, this seems, maybe they just do this in Florida.
This would make me really angry at the guy that brought me there. Like, I don't know who you think I am.
So I think that did occur. I think the guy was like, oh, this is a great place to eat. And so no one really knew the area all that well. So like, oh, sure, we'll go over. He recommends it. And then everyone gets the bill, and you're looking at this guy like, come on.
He had never actually purchased it for himself, though.
Right. Someone else had taken him there.
So this dude has Dutch treated his way through this $80 buffet, and he's like, y'all should come out. It's great.
So he didn't know, though. He didn't know that it was that expensive.
Oh, yeah, right.
He really didn't.
It's believable.
He's ignored. Wait a minute. Okay, I'm with you. Yeah, we're painting a picture of a man. I get you.
It's believable. He's a good-natured man, but I think he just did not know. And like,
not from our culture.
Right.
Yeah. I can't think of experience where I felt more like the dunce, like the guy who ends up on the, you know, like where they have the shows with the guy that does magic, and you're the guy that was fooled. There's always these guys that are fooled by him, and like and they should have seen it coming, like all these weird things. You feel like you should have caught on, and then it all makes sense at the end. That was me. I was the guy that was bamboozled by a magician when I saw all these things, and my mind should have put it together. This is going to be really expensive, Ben. No, seriously, it's going to cost you like your left elbow or something to buy this meal. And then the bill shows. I'm like, oh yeah, all those that wheel of mozzarella that was available on the salad bar. It should have tipped you off.
So I talked to a friend this week who had gone to one on a cruise ship. You know, your cruise ship's full of buffets and food. It was an additional $20 on the cruise ship after you've already paid for all your food.
Oh man,
to go to one of these Brazilian steakhouses. But they went once.
I'm sorry. Is that just the name of very expensive buffets? You put Brazilian before it, and all of a sudden it's very expensive?
Style.
Has anybody been to Brazil? Like, I mean, do they do that in Brazil? Do they got the shards of meat on a stick and the wheel of mozzarella? Or have they, like, is it like a Taco John's perversion where they've made it sound like it's authentic stuff and it's not like that at all?
I don't know what you're saying like about that. My friend John, but he runs a very reputable taco establishment.
He's got Taco Tuesday.
He's got a hat on. It's more than I could say for you, Johnny American.
I don't purport to be that. I just want to eat my Oreo churro and be on with my day. Authentic Mexican Oreo churro. All right. There, that weeded out all the guys that were hanging on to the show casually. Here we go. Let's talk about 9 sins the church is okay with. The proposition here is faith it. Are you going to faithit.com, Dan?
No.
The originator of the article is faithit.com.
Dan clicked on a list.
I saw it and said, hey, did you read this? See if I'm okay with these.
This will make it look like I did some show preparation.
All right, here we go. Here's the introduction. I was in an engineering class the first time I watched the tragic explosion of the Space Shuttle Challenger. Even though I wasn't alive when it happened, I caught a glimpse of the horror thousands must have felt as the events unfolded. And the first question everyone wanted to know was, what happened? After months of investigation, here's what the Rogers Commission, the group commissioned to investigate the explosion, discovered. An O-ring and the right solid rocket booster failed at takeoff. I won't bore you with the details, but an O-ring is a small device relative to the size of a space shuttle, very small. It wasn't something huge like a puncture in the rocket booster or a hole in the cabin that caused this disaster. It was a small, seemingly insignificant O-ring failure. I think there's a lesson here for the church. That's grandiose. What if the big sins, you know, the ones you try hardest to avoid, aren't the greatest threat to your joy in the church's mission? Maybe it's the sins lying underneath, the ones considered normal or acceptable, the ones going undetected, pernicious, that are affecting the church the most. I want to address 9 of these. Okay.
Hey man, I feel
Dave
like
looks worried at the list
there's
already.
There's a lot of what if type of connections going on here.
I feel like I'm guilty of all these already, and you haven't even started.
Yeah.
Continue on.
All right, let's just get into the list.
Okay, number one. The phrases do not fear and do not be afraid appear 365 times in the Bible. Ironic? I think not. And here's what I think the church misses about fear. Let me pose this as a question. What is the opposite of fear? Courage, bravery, William Wallace? Wrong, and right, but you're ruining my point. The opposite of fear is love, and to this, the reality that God is love. So according to the transitive property of mathematics, the opposite of fear is God. If you're a child of God, the one sin that shouldn't plague you is fear, yet Christians are the most fearful people on the earth. Would you agree with that?
That Christians are most fearful?
Are the most fearful people on the earth?
No, I would disagree.
In practice or in principle? Or both? Like, that is not your experience?
That is not my experience.
Okay. Okay. Even our salvation is rooted in fear. Does it bother anyone that the primary method of bringing people to Jesus has been to scare them away from hell? We've been talking about that recently. That does bother me.
Yeah, I agree.
Very much so. Yeah. In fact, it's disgusting. That's fear language. The antithesis of God. Look at what John says. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, for fear has to do with punishment. And whoever fears has not been perfected in love, 1 John 4:18. The church is scared to make decisions out of fear. Christians are hesitant to step into dangerous situations out of fear. The catalyst for our obedience is fear. Where's the love? Several weeks ago, I decided to remove the words fear, scared, and terrified from my vocabulary. Maybe you should do the same. It could change how you see the world and God. Where's it coming from?
I don't know that I've ever, like, woken up and thought, I fear. You know, like I don't know that I can remove these principles from my daily living, because I don't know that I anticipate any of those things that he just mentioned.
Well, out of the 365 times the Bible says, do not fear, I wonder how many of those are times, like, I can think of every time an angel appears, like, some dude's out doing their thing, and all of a sudden an angel appears, like, whoa, what's this? The first thing the angel says is, do not fear, because, like, well, yeah. They just...
It would freak you out.
Yeah. Something that, like, you should fear.
Yeah, it's like,
you
know, something totally unusual is happening here. I don't know, you know. So you got to kind of take those out, you know, of what he's saying here.
Yeah.
That's kind of inflating the statistics here. I don't know. I'm trying to think. Does Scripture say anywhere that fear is sin?
It's always put in a command form. Do not be afraid.
Yeah, yeah. And
I mean, I kind of feel like fear is a biological structure that was built into you to warn you that something funky is going down, right?
It's like a lack of faith is a sign of, I don't trust God.
I'm going to be like, hey, there's something, there's a car coming at me very fast. There's a sense of fear in me that I should move. Like, it's a biological reaction to something, impending something, right? Or something out of the ordinary, something that I need to respond to.
You're talking about a fight or flight type of response. It's,
I guess, maybe that's
danger, and I better either run or fight against it.
Yeah, and maybe that's just the category I'm putting fear in. Like I just, I feel like, you know, God innated that in you to say, hey, man, you better do something. There's input required for you to get out of the way of something.
Yeah, and actually,
or engage in something.
I would use Dan's example as a good one, right? Like, I mean, realistically, right? You find some sort of figure that appears before you. I don't think the reaction that we're supposed to read into say, don't be such an idiot for being afraid. It's, you run into something that rightfully has caused you to fear. I want you to know that it's of God. There's no reason to fear.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I think that's the right train. And I think maybe what he's getting at here, if I can sympathize with it at all, it would be that sometimes the things that we seem to have fear in are things that we otherwise would purport to trust God in. And so the question is like, that is not appropriate counterbalance. Like, I can't say I trust God with this and then be afraid of it.
Right.
I think that's the nature of and the truth is, it's disingenuous. Like, mm-hmm. if I meet a person who says, I love and follow Jesus, and then they're like, I'm afraid all the time, and I say, well, then I don't get it.
Yeah. Either what
Jesus
kind of powerful God do you follow? Because it seems to me that you're kind of scared of everything.
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. I disagree with his word fear for the sin that we are okay with. I change that to lack of trust. I don't trust God. The lack of faith. That would call that. That's
that seems like something that we have an issue with.
Yeah,
and we seem to be all right.
Or we seem to be okay when people like, well, yeah, you're just being smart. You're just being logical. You're being.
I think fear is the practical manifestation of someone who's lacking trust. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Either God is who he is, or he's not. I think. I mean, that's really what it comes down to, right?
Yeah,
like, either you trust it or you don't, and like, you're gonna have to embrace that one way or the other.
Yeah, if he's not sovereign, then you better get your act together. Otherwise, if he is sovereign, then he has the act together.
Right. And if he's not sovereign, then he's a liar, and it's time to bail.
All of the congregational votes you see in Scripture are based on fear. Like, hey, Moses, how about we vote to go back to Egypt?
Yeah, right.
Mistake. You know, that's, you know.
Watch out for groupthink.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Hey, man, that's scary all the time anyway.
Yeah.
Groups of people are freaking me out. Hey, I have fear of groups of people.
What were we talking about, though? It's groups of people that get on board with like nostalgia on things that have barely passed, and lists with counts in them.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt.
Anyway, back to our nine sins the church is okay with.
I'm a little scared about what's next.
All right, number two. We're going to have to truncate these down here. Apathy. Apathy's best friends are passivity and entitlement. Together, they're a vicious threesome. There's nothing mediocre or normal about God. His power is beyond comprehension. His beauty is beyond description. His love is beyond measure. Same God who created the universe and formed stars desires a relationship with you, yet the attitude's often, okay, God loves me, that's great. What's for lunch? No, you don't get it, bro. God loves you, and you're content with, that's great. What? Our apathetic approach to God explains a lot about why people in America aren't lining up to become Christians. I mean, think about it. How many Christians have you met that left you thinking, wow, I want to be like them? That's also fair. But this should be the norm, right? Am I way off here? Shouldn't you be transformed by God that people want to ask about your life, even if they hate God? In Scripture, when men and women truly experience God, everything changes, everything. So that begs the question, have you experienced God?
Yeah, the stories are inherently outrageous. If you're apathetic to it, then you just did not understand the story. Either it's something that it's so outrageous you reject it, or it's so outrageous that it just changes the way that you look at the world. But it shouldn't be something that just kind of reaffirms, it's like, okay, yeah, everything's all right. It's like,
right, that's at least dealing with scripture at face value. Mm-hmm. Like, agreed. Like, you either have to accept it for what it purports to be, or reject it, taking it in mediocrely and be like, oh, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
It denies what, I mean, if Jesus is to be believed as, you're going to give up your life and you're going to take up the cross and follow me, or basically follow me in what it is that I'm doing, mm-hmm. Either we're skipping that or we're rejecting it if we take it in such a mediocre fashion. I would agree.
Mm-hmm. I'm totally on with this one, yeah.
Yeah.
And we accept it as a whole. The church is like,
I don't think it's apathy, though. It's dishonesty. Like, we're being dishonest about what we're reading. Mm-hmm. Right, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you're going to read something like that, if you're going to be honest about what the Bible is talking about, you need to be honest about what it's asking for, and you need to be honest what it purports to do and know and direct and call you to. And so I'm not sure that it's apathy. I think it's actually, it may be an unintended dishonesty, but like, it's just dishonest to act like it is what it isn't, and that it can be kind of digested and melded with a bunch of other things that you've got going on. Mm-hmm. All right. Mm-hmm. Gluttony. Oh, boy. In my younger days, I would literally eat myself sick. I mean, if I ordered food, I ate all of it, period. Do you do that, Nick?
No. We were just talking about a buffet.
Sorry.
I once went to Brazilian buffet with a number of other gentlemen.
All preachers.
Oh, man. Looking back, I see that my attitude was gluttonous. And the gluttony wasn't that I ate myself sick. It was that I used the gift God gave me on myself in excess. Gluttony is primarily about the heart. It's craving for excess. Gluttony says, those voids God is supposed to fill, don't worry about that. I will fill them. Gluttony happens. That seems like a redefinition of gluttony. You sing, as long as your eyes are fixed on Jesus, your heart's desire is for him. Is the world not desperate for this message? As we gorge our stomachs with food and flood our houses with trinkets, our discontent only increases. Where are the Jesus followers who have fixed their eyes completely on him, throwing away anything that treads the line between want and need? Where are the Christians who will feast in excess on God? So I think I can maybe get on board with the principle. I don't know. Gluttony seems like the wrong category. I think the point is that we are self-reliant on things that that God says he will otherwise provide. And actually, that's back to a trust issue.
Yeah.
It's kind of number two.
Yeah, I don't know what he's suggesting here. Is like, if you haven't like sold everything that you own, then you know you're a gluttonous fool, and you know like you don't really believe what you say you believe. Is that kind of what he's getting at?
Well, so I mean, when he says I don't know, when we're trying to fill voids with things that aren't God things, I don't know.
Like I don't feel good. I'm feeling sad, so I'm going to eat rather than pray.
So you're talking about emotional eating?
Yeah, I suppose. Is that?
See, we've entered a realm that I'm not real good in, but continue on.
So, I mean, he lost me, as we gorge our stomachs with food and flood our houses with trinkets. I think the base level is, I think, does he have this on here? Hold on. Let me look. It's like number seven. So it's greed. Now, I think that is something we, especially the American church, is baptized. Mm-hmm. We're okay with greed. We won't argue about who's smoking what and who you're holding hands with. But, like, you got 90% of your people walking in the door who have got a greed problem, and we don't really want to talk about that all that often. I would agree with the underlying premise right there. I think that's the case. And frankly, that's still a measure of dishonesty. So I would agree that kind of is an underlying thing. He kind of lost me on some of the rest of that stuff.
It seems like it's kind of going in the direction of a type of idolatry where you're filling a – where you should be worshiping God, instead you're worshiping something else. You're finding something else to give your life meaning. And instead of replacing, you know, instead of God being the center of your life, it's like, hey, I'll have food be it.
Right.
I mean, from a Christian perspective, that sounds really stupid on its face, right? You know what I'm saying? I believe in this all powerful God, but there's a turkey leg. And I feel like the turkey leg has got a lot going for it. It's been freshly cooked.
Well, you know, you have your two casseroles in your car and you're driving to the Church of Potluck and you drive past the homeless community and think, man, sucks to be them, and you just keep going.
That's right.
to the church potluck.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like, well, yeah, but we've got this party planned, and we really need this food.
See, once again, like even that example, it just makes it sound very ridiculous.
Yeah, we are.
You know,
at times. And
you know what's interesting is that, like, if you think about the end around a way that a lot of modern theology will get you there is, it's not say I worship the turkey leg. It's I worship God because he provides me a turkey leg. And so, it's just an end around, right? And it's the same process as we just kind of use God as the bartering tool to say, actually, I really want to worship this, and I'll call it a blessing that he gave me a turkey leg thanks, God, for this thing that I wanted to worship that wasn't right. you.
The Lord has blessed me with a turkey leg and a good-sized house.
So then God's not God. He's just my tool.
He's just a guy that works for me that provides turkey legs and houses.
Thanks, Jesus. You can clock out. You've done well this week.
Right. These are categoric mistakes.
Agreed. Number five, flattery. I erased this like five times, but God kept telling me to put it back. So I did, with hesitancy. I love you, God. I like performing. I always have. And while there's nothing wrong with the spotlight, there's a lot wrong with making yourself the center of it. If your identity is tied to man's praise, you'll be eternally discontent. So that's true anyway, just because man is fickle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. If your identity is tied to man's praise, you'll be eternally discontent. People are fickle. We said that. They're here today and gone tomorrow. They're for you one day, against you the next. They love you when you agree with them, dislike you when you don't. Yet we love human praise. At least I do. Exhibit A, Instagram, Snapchat, Boova on Facebook. While I love social media, there are also platforms that perpetuate flattery. You post pictures about your life hoping the world will like it. Who cares if it's not the real you? You need the approval. So even if you need 30 minutes to find that perfect selfie, it's worth the time. Jesus, however, didn't need the praise and glory of men. He didn't care what they thought. His only concern was doing the will of God. The attitude is what the world is desperate to see. It's hard to point people to Jesus if you need their approval. Let's be honest. It's hard to point people to Jesus if you need their approval. He said the same thing twice. And when you need the approval of others, your life will have more ups and downs than the Goliath at Six Flags in Atlanta. I rode that beast. I know. Has anybody been on the Goliath at Six Flags in Atlanta?
I've never been to Atlanta.
No.
The reference is lost on me then. flattery. What do you think?
You did a really good job reading that.
Sorry.
Convoluted. It kind of goes back to the basic replace God with something else. In this case, it's just the crowd's approval.
Yeah.
So.
And like, I mean, that's a fairly easy thing to get sucked into. Like having people appreciate what you do or say you did a good job. You know, but like it's nice. But like the truth is, yeah, I mean, they can turn on you just as fast as they said that you were great. And they are fickle. I mean, that's it's hard to say that because, like, if you live your entire life that way, you will live such a protected, guarded life that, like, you never got invested in anybody deep enough to know them, right? Like, if, like, I can't trust you enough because you might hurt me, you know, then you can never actually have a relationship with anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it just depends on how much weight you put on it, right? Like, every great betrayal came from being party to someone who it meant something if they betrayed you. However, every great love and connection relationship came because you were willing for that to be the case, right? And so I don't know that you can't.
That sounded very wise.
I got it on a fortune cookie.
at a Brazilian steakhouse. It cost me $8 for the fortune cookie.
I didn't know they did this in Brazil. They said, well, you kind of paid a lot for the meat, so.
We felt obligated to give you a cookie.
Here's a scroll inside
you
of the chocolate.
Fortune, thing. Here's a cookie.
What an aptly name.
in preaching, in ministry, that flattery really is pretty worthless. You know, I used to, at my very first church, you know, every Sunday, the same old lady would come by, great job, Larry. I go, well, my name's not Larry,
but I'll pass it along.
Job, I'm 20. You know,
actually, it works out pretty good at our church. Every once in a while, Ben will preach, and since I look just like him, I either get the praise or the disdain on the way through. You know, I'll walk out first, then be like, "You did a nice job." I'm like, "Well, thank you." Or, you know, you talk a little fast. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm working on it."
You guys had to dress the same those days. That'd be awesome.
Yeah. I'll just put myself up as a lamb to slaughter for your amusement, Dan.
Ben can give you the nod. Yeah, why don't you stop? You face the public for me.
Yeah. Hey, can you hold this this X, and I'll put some strings on myself, and you can just puppet me around.
All right, here we go. Number six, comfort. Comfort might be the patriarch of the church-approved sins family. When the church becomes comfortable, Christianity starts to die. Christians must be extremely intentional with their thoughts and actions to avoid comfort. If not, you become resistant to change. You start making secondary issues primary. You begin to see the mission is catering to insiders rather than reaching outsiders. Actually, I think that's a case in point on driving the casserole to the church potluck instead of stopping it, giving the guy that's hungry.
Yeah.
That's a secondary issue. That's a problem. And here's the thing about the sin of comfort. Once it shows up, it's extremely difficult to remove. When you challenge comfort, people just don't just get angry. They get fighting mad. Comfort will even tell you to crucify an innocent man. The church can't be missional and comfortable at the same time. The church can't be missional and comfortable at the same time. It's time to make a decision. Is he doing that on purpose? I just got bad formatting on this website because it's making me look silly. Anyway, can't be missional and comfortable at the same time. It's time to make a decision.
Yeah.
I think it's an honest – actually, it goes back to dishonesty thing. You can't say I follow Jesus. And if Jesus went and talked to people of ill repute and he fed people that needed fed and he sought for justice and mercy and love and the truth of God to people and you're not doing that, then you're simply not following Jesus. You're following something. It's not him.
We met for as a church for like 12 years in a school, and whenever like a new family moved to town, whatever, they'd come check out the church. Always the very first question, I mean, number one question, if I'd be talking to a new family, would be like, "Well, when are you guys going to get in the building?" I'm like, "Well, that has nothing to do with. I mean, really? I mean, what does it matter?
So we can sit in it.
Yeah, it's like we just don't want to. This looks like a lot of work. We're not helping with the setup. I know, but it sure seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, we just like to heat a place that we're not at most of the week. And if you guys aren't doing that, then we can't come here.
But it was kind of a comfort thing, you know.
I mean, like you know where it comes from, but like it's just it's the wrong idea. That was one of the we were halfway through this building process and things were they were going okay, but it was taking a long time. And I thought, you know, if we're gonna put this building together, and as a church, we're gonna come here and we're gonna sit in it, and we're not gonna be outdoing the work of God, but we're just going to be happy that we're in here. I said, God, I'll burn it down. Do it right now. I prayed it out in this parking lot. I said, if you need to burn this thing down, you burn it down. Put an endangered owl in the rafters, whatever it takes for us not to be able to move forward with this, because I don't want us to build something and sit in there. And it's a real risk, right? Because you've introduced this notion of comfort, and it is, once you get used to it, it is hard to pull back out of it. And it's something that I think we have to be careful about. I think the point isn't to say God wants you to be uncomfortable, but it's stagnant. It's like if you're following Christ and Jesus is moving, and that's what his life and ministry demonstrates, if you're not doing that, then you've become stagnant and comfortable, and that's the risk.
And I think the modern church kind of caters to comfort. You know, when they're out there trying to market to people.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Come, and we'll make mm-hmm. you comfortable.
Although, I mean, we went with decently comfortable chairs.
Well, because
that's true.
Oh, never mind.
We could have got iron stools, and we didn't. You guys have fed into this.
That was what earlier years.
Here's the deal.
I've made mistakes.
Nobody sells a spiked communion plate. And you're like, what does this world come to? Doesn't anyone love Jesus?
We even went to bikerchurch.com.
Bikerchurch. That's awesome. I bet they sell cool
Here's
stuff.
Here's the thing, though. I can't remember if we've talked about this, but like, there's something about guys that like biker churches,
uh-huh.
like what the church is always trying to create what bikers do automatically.
Yeah.
Like people who love each other, who spend life together, who there's brotherhood.
Die for each other.
Yeah. I mean, like the very thing that the church is always trying to manufacture, and frankly, it's trying to do that because we stink at it. We're not very good at being together and creating community. Like you go to a biker church, or even just you take a biker church out of it, just a group of bikers. Mm-hmm. Like that's the community the church wants to create.
Yeah.
We just stink at creating it. Like we don't create an atmosphere of which people actually naturally want to get in relationships. I saw there was a guy that did a biker church, and he was kind of explaining how things went and these interactions with the people. And I thought, man, that's it.
I used to, when I was in Cass County, in Iowa here, I became like the biker funeral guy.
Yeah.
And it's just like one led to another, because then we kind of got to know them. And I tell you, I've seen them in their best and their worst, and they do. They come together. I'll never forget a two-mile-line processional of Harleys rumbling the entire community going on a funeral to someone's burial. And just the way those guys, I mean, they hug like nobody hugs. They cry. They laugh. They party. They do it. I mean, it's together. It's a community for sure.
How do you make the church more like a biker gang? Something to put the thought on.
We're going to hand out free leathers next service.
Hey, man, we get all kinds of people. You're handing out free leather.
I mean,
can we be discerning on the free leather? I don't want to imply anything, but I just took
No, man. Excuse me, sir. You're going to need take two. That's not going to do it.
Number eight.
Or at least some long lace. Sorry.
There's laws in this country. Sorry, Ben. We've derailed the community that is the biker church and made it tawdry.
Patriotism, number eight. Cue the nasty emails. Maybe it's just me, but I can't picture Jesus waving an American flag while showing off his I Love America tattoo. Jesus wasn't against the government. In fact, if you're a Jesus follower, the Bible calls you to pray for your nation and for your leaders. But Jesus was very clear about how God's name would become famous throughout the world. The church, not the government, not a nation, the church. When your allegiance is torn between your country and your God, American ideals begin to shape your faith more than God. And you transpose American values onto God, believing God would be an American, and think like an American. Celebrate American values. That's great. But at the end of the day, your citizenship is not with America. It's in heaven. We've talked a lot about that recently.
Mm-hmm.
And that a lot of the things that people, I feel like that they, where they're not dealing with Christianity honestly, it's because it looks like God's an American. And we've piloted some of the stuff that our country believes in and is founded upon on to God and said he must have he's baptized this and this he, and this must be honoring to him. And I it's not completely mutually exclusive, but there is a lot about our country that is I don't think I could put on to God. Certainly couldn't. So I think that is very much a risk, and we do need to be very, because we tie that, like, what it's a popular phrase, like God and country. We want to mail those.
God bless America.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's made its way into the nomenclature, and I think it is, at least if we're being honest, disassociated with some of the truth of Scripture, with some of the things that we care about, either as a nation or as a people. Number nine. That's nine. End of the list. Lying. If gluttony is the elephant in the room everyone sees, but no one talks about, lying is the elephant in the room no one sees. Lying is so socially acceptable, even in Christian circles, that it often goes undetected. We're desensitized to it. And here's why this is dangerous for Christians. There's a rarely discussed passage in Matthew 5:33 where Jesus confronts the Pharisees about oaths. Most Americans only hear the word oath when a celebrity lies in court under oath. But Jesus isn't talking about oaths in this passage. He's talking about integrity. Here's what Jesus is saying. You should live with such high integrity that your word doesn't need attachments to make it legitimate. So typical phrases like, I promise, or I swear, or I put it on my mom's grave, should never come from your mouth. Frank, come on, man. Aren't you interpreting that correctly? Say you promise. These words are a kick in the pants, right? If you're like me, you say things all the time and never follow through. You lie to make yourself sound better. You lie to stay out of trouble. You lie to get ahead. Sometimes you lie to just lie. Jesus says there's no place for it if you're a Christian. Your word matters. If you say something, God expects you to do it. It's better to tell the truth and lose your job than lie and keep it. How serious is this? Jesus says anything more than our word is from the evil one, Satan. That's real.
Hey, so like if I'm being completely honest here, that changed the way that I live my life. I didn't realize how many small lies I told. Most of them were centered around why I was late to work that day. And so I forced myself to stop lying about that, and it was amazingly freeing. Like it's kind of one of those things where you know, I looked at it and I'm like, is this really that big of a deal if I said, "Hey man, I just my car didn't start" or something? Like it's really not hurting, you know? Until like I actually felt the freeing feeling of like knowing that I didn't make up a story. Like I just said, "Look, I woke up late. I didn't hear my alarm. I've let you down. That's what happened." And like it was amazingly, I didn't think that it could be possible. It's one of those promises that, you know, you hear God put out and you're like, I don't know, man. I don't feel like that's practically going to work at all. Like I'm probably going to lose my job and everyone's going to hate me because I tell a lot of lies. And then I started giving it a shot. And, you know, I feel like I've gotten way more joy out of just being bluntly honest. Mm-hmm. And so, I got to back that one up. I feel like that's very freeing.
No, and I think that's the misunderstanding of some of these things, right? Is that we look at some of the stuff that God says is a shackle. He's when what Mike is describing is, because you're living in truth, there's freedom in that.
It doesn't sound right. It's going to make any sense. I'm telling you, I'm with you. I agree. It sounds like it's not going to work out, but like it just really has. I can just testify that it has.
I think I've had that same experience. The things that other people would look and say that's shackle. I said it is through those things in which I actually have. Feel free, and not like a high spiritual. I feel in freedom, but like literally, I feel that there is a lack of a weight upon my life and the things that I do when I have integrity in my life. And frankly, I mean that's true even outside of the Bible. But the Bible helps me. Provides my levels of how I understand what integrity is. When otherwise, without some sort of fixed point, it becomes very difficult. It's a moving target. And people's level of integrity comes to, well, no one else cares, so is it a big deal? And the truth is, I mean, yeah, it still is. You're still shackled. You didn't have a party who pointed it out at you.
My biggest problem is an unintentional lie. I made my daughter very disappointed in me today. Evidently, at 2 in the morning, as I was going to bed, as she kind of sat under her bedroom door, like her light was on, and she heard me. She goes, "Hey, are we going to go look for a phone tomorrow?" I'm like, you know, I didn't want to talk about it. Yeah, sure. You know, yeah. I just that'll end the conversation. And somewhere in there, evidently, she had 9 o'clock was her plan. At 9 o'clock, we're going to the store to look at phones. And my brother's in town. Like, he was leaving that morning. I thought, I don't know what's going on that morning. You know, I just, whatever. You know, okay. So I was just ending the conversation and going to bed. And I've kind of had to live with that today. Like, I guess I lied. I couldn't even tell you I said that.
Yeah.
But I did. You know, I can remember, you know. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, we'll look for a phone sometime. You know. Anyway, it's usually I do stuff like that. I'll say something to end a conversation, to just agree to let's move on, and then not follow through with what I said because I forget it. I discard it.
You know?
And it wasn't a lie. But to them it was.
Yeah. Yeah. They're on the other side of something that you said that you otherwise didn't come through, and it feels like a lack of integrity. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's an integrity issue.
Yep. All right.
You guys okay with that?
Yeah, I didn't. Yes.
Yes.
Says, sometimes the undetected sins are the most toxic. My hope is you will see this as an opportunity to grow. I also realize there are some church-approved sins I didn't mention. It's your turn. I don't know that you had to... I mean, it's a little bit of a clickbait thing, right? Nine sins Christians are okay with. Like, I think this is an interesting conversation and an opportunity to be kind of self-reflective on what we seem to be okay with. It seems a little bit more heady than the introduction seemed a little bit more heady than maybe what it was.
Yeah.
Helpful or otherwise. Clickbaited by a faithit.com. I think I could have seen that.
You got to learn to play the game, bro.
All right. Well, if you have more that you think, I, to be honest with you, I don't really want you to share them with us. It seems unnecessary.
We've gone through nine. That's enough.
Yeah,
that's,
I think we're good there. I mean, talk about it among your friends. But here's the deal. I mean, don't invest in finger pointing here. Just, I mean, use it to filter. That's what God's word is help you do. Read it. Believe, like, be honest about what it's asking and then react accordingly. I don't know if we need to spend a bunch of time on it. Like, well, Chuck is a this and this.
Yeah. Well, I think the point is my sin that most of us accept is just as sinful as the one we will protest against.
That is probably the main point.
It's still
the one that I like to swing the hammer at people about, you know, and then I'm over here like, well, mine deserves at least just a pat on the wrist, like, oh, do better, you know. Yeah. But the one everyone else is willing to grab a hammer out and beat a guy with, you know, that's the big ticket item. And then the one that you're committing, you're like, well, the Lord has grace for me because I'm me. I don't know if I was in the Bible.
It's a little weird. So,
it was like it's somewhere in the middle. It's like Mike is okay for most things.
Yeah.
And so that's the embarrassing part, and that's the part that really, it makes God unbelievable, right? Like, it makes that whole thing that you said you built your whole life on, your whole belief structure, in a God that gives you a pass to act like a jerk and act like you don't love anybody, but the stuff you do that stinks is, it's probably fine because you're you. Well, who would want to get involved with a God like that? He sounds terrible. And like he doesn't care for anybody except for special old you, you know? And that was probably, I mean, that's probably the main point. Is if you can look at that and like if you're gonna attempt to say that you're following Jesus in any capacity, and you're gonna present a God that's basically a lie from what the Bible said, so you look better, like you're not following Jesus, right? You're trying to create a you plus Jesus situation, and you're mucking it up. You're making it look silly.
Yeah.
I look at this and not so much, hey, how is everyone messed up? You know, they've got their sin that I don't like, and I've got my sin that I like, and so we are all steeped in shame. I don't see that as being something so useful as much as just kind of looking through this and saying, all right, in what way have I not been trusting God as fully as I should? Like, for example, lying, it's like, okay, I don't quite trust God's reality, so I'm going to fabricate my own and try and come up with my own story about why I was late or why whatever, and now that's on me, and it's like I don't trust the reality that God has already created that I apparently live in, and so I'm going to try taking it from him and doing that. It's like, you know, what is it about this list? In the things that I'm failing in what way am I just not trusting God, and how can I turn that around and actually learn to trust him?
You know, right, we were talking about that in relatives to some, related to some of our end time discussion stuff, is like, the reason people are trying to scare people into heaven is because they seem to flat out not trust God's marketing plan. They're like, well, Jesus didn't communicate these things. He communicates them in frankly, hope, love, optimism. This is what we have for you. And we've decided, well, Lord, it's just not doing it. Let's go scare them.
Yeah.
Let's go threaten them. Let's go make sure they understand. I mean, we don't care for God's marketing plan. And say, well, we've amped this up a little bit to kind of make some heads.
We've added spiritual vacuum that sucks people up prior to big devastation.
So much for the good part of good news. We'll just discard that.
We'll just go with the news, the straight-up news.
There's times where there's people talking. I'm like, I don't want to spend eternity with that guy.
No doubt. If he's getting in, I'm out.
That seems real difficult to deal with, this fella.
This is what fires him up?
Yeah. Come on. And that's the thing. Is like, this has come up in conversation a couple times. Is like, I get to heaven because Jesus gets in, and then he's the only legitimate guy invited to the party. And then he turns around, and he looks at me, and he looks at you and says, yeah, he's with me. And then I get to go in. I get to go in because Jesus gets to go in. He's a legitimate character. And the other people are trying to try and say, like, here's how you want to spend eternity with God, because I can scare you from wanting to go to this thing and rile you up enough that you just go hightail it in past Jesus and hit the punch bowl.
Yeah.
I'm like, realistically, that just doesn't seem appropriate.
No.
It doesn't seem like how eternity works. All right. You're listening to Live from the Path. Nine sins the church is okay with. Try not to be okay with that stuff. You know, let your yes be a yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Just tell it like it is.
Mike, what do you got over there?
You ready? We're ready for some round table.
Yeah, yeah. Dear Life from the Path.
Okay, here we go. Dear Life from the Path. I'm retiring at the end of this year after 50 years of full-time employment, and I'm very excited about it. Looking back over my life, I see there have been several life-changing events: marriage, the births of our children, buying a home, and now retirement. My wife gets irritated every time I say, about twice a week, when I retire. I'm looking forward to all sorts of activities that I'll have time for. Why can't she be excited too? She makes snide remarks like, well, when you retire, you won't have anything to say. The implication is that all I talk about is my retirement, which isn't true, and if it were true, it's a big deal to me. What should I say to my wife?
Is she afraid of this?
I mean, something's up.
A lot of women don't like it when the men retire. Then suddenly they're invading their kingdom. Mm-hmm. Now, it's been their kingdom for 50 years, and now all of a sudden, you know, John's coming home.
Sitting in the chair.
And he cares
out.
About what kind of spoons we have? Or
go out to the garage, John.
Yeah.
Leave my home alone.
Brandon, you have your marriage counseling. These fellows, they're in front of you, and they say, hey, we just don't know. I don't know how to tell my wife. She doesn't seem to be supportive of me. What do you say?
I mean, she's got to deal with it. that's a vows, right? You know?
Well, that's true.
You know, here's the deal. I like Brandon's straight-laced marriage counseling.
For better or for
hey,
worse.
Look, man, you made vows. I feel like you're not getting out of this deal. You know, straighten it up.
Yeah. You know, it's bought and paid for. It's you know?
Yeah.
You're married.
You own the cow, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. You made it this far, and now you're at the retirement side. There's no.
It should be on the downward slide.
Yeah.
Now, is it possible that that maybe the way that we run marriages that they create such a separate lifestyle that when the two of them have to meld back together with no kids to bank on or no job to find identity in, that you basically don't know each other?
There's a legitimate crisis in every marriage. Retirement, ooh. It really is.
Well, I don't want to look forward to this, Dan. Tell me that it doesn't have to be so.
You don't think it has to be so?
Okay. Okay, good.
It won't be for Cheryl and I. We have a better relationship than that.
Well, crap. What are you saying about me?
I'm not saying you. I'm talking about this guy, this gal.
Okay.
Wait. So we're trying to sympathize with the wife here. What is it that what are dudes doing when they're retiring? Like, is it just that they're hanging around the house?
They're following her around, and, you know, just like, would you just leave me alone? I hear that a lot from, I'm like, I don't know that many people, but the people who have talked to me over the years, that's the thing. It's like, he follows me around. He's always home. He's always asking questions. For 50 years, I've folded the towels this way. Now he's saying, why do you fold them that way? Or, you know what? It's just things that are really dumb.
Hey, so
but it's annoying.
I think I'd totally do that, right? Like, I mean,
I bet you would.
My wife totally takes care of most of the grocery shopping. Right?
You doing that now?
And then I start sticking my face in there. I'm like, hey, what do you mean? You didn't get any combo pizza rolls?
Yeah.
I mean, that should have been a standard all these years. What's happened? You know, I could see how that could be very.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a big deal.
When you're so used to doing something on your own, and then all of a sudden someone wants to put their input, and you're like, I've been mowing the lawn for like 20 years. You want to tell me how to mow it now? That seems really unnecessary.
I kind of feel like I went through some of the same sort of discussions when Becky and I first got married, just because, you know, I think I've got some kind of great idea about how to do things. And Becky's had a way that works, and she's a legitimate adult. She knows how to do things. And here I am coming in trying to, you know, teach her how to do it. Come on, really? She's an adult. She knows how to do it.
So,
but are we saying the man is in the wrong? I'm not comfortable with what you're saying.
Kind of, yeah.
I mean, that's where her anxiety is coming from. Yeah. She's seen this in other couples.
Am I hearing that the advice is to say he should have started earlier following her around and getting up in her affairs so this isn't such a surprise?
He's to lay down the law right away.
He needs to ramp it up a little bit. You're just not a smooth character.
Okay.
That's his problem.
He needs to get some hobbies, and he needs to make sure she knows he's not just going to be following her around every day.
Yeah.
And
this is a weird picture of marital bliss.
Here's how you keep a marriage running strong. Keep away from each other.
Get a hobby and leave me alone.
You know, I like having a puppy, but when it follows me everywhere I go, I'm like, would you just go take a nap or something? You know, it's the same way with a wife and a husband. Go take a nap.
Well, listen here, wife. Let me put this to you this way. You're like a dog, really, that follows me around, and I want you to take a nap. Marriage advice from Dan.
I think the guy is more the dog.
See what Secular had to say versus Dan's animal analogy. Secular says, you might start by asking why her reaction is to rain on your parade about something you're clearly looking forward to. She may be worried about how her life will change once you retire, or she may be a tad jealous. but you won't know until you have a frank conversation with her that isn't passive aggressive or tinged with sarcasm. Well, that takes out every conversation I ever have. I don't even know how to talk to people.
You're going to have to hire a guy. Here, babe. I got Larry to talk to you.
I've hired Wilford Brimley. He's having a good diabetes month. He needs some work. Here we go. Dear, that's terrible. Dear Life from the Path, I've been in a relationship with a woman, Wendy, for more than a year. She has one child whose father isn't in the boy's life, so I fill the role of his daddy. We are now expecting a child together. Wendy had had a bad experience with her ex not wanting anything to do with his child. She also has a friend who has had kids with different men who ended up not treating them the same. Lately, Wendy has been pushing me away and trying to get me to leave. I have no plans to leave, and I don't want to. My question is, how do I make her understand that I am not the same as the other men, and I want to be there for both children? This is kind of simple advice, man. Just prove that you're not them. Stay. You know what I'm saying? Like, understand what she's doing. Like, I understand that's hard to take, right? Like, it's hard to take that. But you can see what she's doing.
Yeah, she did that to the first guy, too, I'm guessing.
You can see what she's doing if you love her. Love her completely. Mm-hmm. Let her go through it. Let her battle. She's trying to protect herself and her kids. That's an honest response, right? But, like, prove that you're not the other guy and stay.
Yeah.
Don't let it get to you. Don't let it beat you down, you know.
It's hard in relationships, whether it be marital relationships or friendships or between husband or mother and father, like your kids and stuff, is being in relationships where you're not reaffirmed, right? Where it doesn't feel mutual, where you're putting in effort and you don't feel like you're getting it back. Yeah. But the truth is that from her position, I think that's just going to be your situation for a while, right? She's trying to protect, and so you're not going to see some of this reciprocation. But it is disingenuous to act like that you don't know where that's coming from, and it's a manner of it's unloving to say I know why you're doing this, and I'm gonna ignore that and take it personally, and not invest in this relationship. So I think you're gonna have to just know that there's gonna be a time in your life of which you're gonna love, and it's not gonna be reciprocated. But the nature of love doesn't require that. Mm-hmm. It certainly makes it easier.
It does.
It makes it easier to love someone when it's coming back. But I mean the true nature of what love is means that it doesn't have to.
That's right. I will love you even if you're not being loving to me.
Yeah.
Right. And that is, I mean, there's no doubt about it. That's draining. It is emotionally draining. Yeah. And you have to really love somebody to know whether that's going to stick. But if you can rock that and realize that, like, you can truly say I love you despite how you feel about me, that's a very pure form of love.
He has to be committed to that to the long term, too. Yeah. I mean, it's not going to be 3 weeks and suddenly everything's better. He's got to just keep. Right. It'll be difficult, but it is doable.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's just hard, right? Yeah. It's just very hard.
I think that shows out in and maybe this isn't true for you guys, but like I mean, the times where I feel like I am, the most unloving acting towards my wife is when she has treated me in a way that I didn't appreciate, right? And so my honest reaction is like it opens up a floodgate and says, well, that's what we're doing, eh?
Yeah.
I get to treat you unlovingly.
Here's a list I've been keeping.
and that's foolish, right? Because the truth is every argument stems from two people who are willing to engage in an argument. If you could find one reasonable person and you're given your day-to-day who wasn't willing to engage on that level and was able to just kind of take it for a little bit. Because if there's no reason to say, hey, man, my wife's really acting unreasonable today. She's acting like I don't do X, Y, Z. And then my reaction is to then become unreasonable myself and show her the what for. And like, what did we just do? All I did was volunteer to be the unreasonable party that broke the camel's back. If my wife is being unreasonable, if I think that, right? But she's not tend to be that way, then I should have some sympathy on my wife and say, something's up. Something's going on in her life that's causing her to react to me in this way. Why would I affirm that by acting the way that she is accusing me of to prove the point? Like, it's so stupid. But like, that's what we wait for someone to act like a fool. Yeah. Like, we're waiting for the floodgate. For the idiot parade to get to launch out so that
like
we can
there's
say,
a small fool inside of you that's been wanting to get off the bench, and you're like, just give me a reason. Yeah. I got a fool ready to come in.
If normal relationships are the blacktop only of elementary school recess, like soon as somebody makes a false remark, it's green flag, and everybody's out and about acting however they want to act.
All right, let's see what Secular says. Secular says, a marriage proposal and joint premarital counseling might go a long way in helping your girlfriend understand that you aren't planning to disappear in a puff of smoke. It might also give you more insight to why she wants to push you away, just in case it's because she isn't as serious about you as you are about her.
Do you think that's wise? You think it's wise to the marriage proposal?
The room is aghast.
He seems like he's already committed to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm asking. Like,
that's
I wonder
where I would have started.
Is,
I mean.
But he might lose any opportunity, right? Because if her current position, he says, "Will you marry me?" She could just flat out say no, and it's done.
What do you mean it's done?
No,
doesn't mean you're broken up. Just means
I feel like if she's trying to push him away, this gives a good sense of finality.
We just described a strong-willed love, even if you're not loving to me, man. He will stay without a marriage proposal.
Yeah. Now hold on,
he's loving.
He might just have to come back and ask her every week.
Yeah,
I mean, at some point he becomes a creeper.
Haven't you seen whatever romantic comedy I have in my head? I don't know. What's the one where they kiss in the rain? It's some kind of epic.
That's all of them.
The Letters. What's it called?
I don't know. I don't watch those.
I don't know.
The
Letters.
Oh, The Notebook.
The Notebook. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
Nicholas Sparks.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. See, I'm in the culture. Crap, I'm not. Anyway.
Hey, anybody that has to go, yeah, I'm of the culture. Is not a guy
look
of the culture.
Unless he's a dairy farmer.
Hey, man. That plays.
That does play. Like the one time he told it at the gas station at 5:30 with the rest of the farmers, you know, I'm in the culture. And then he tries it the next day. And I'm like, come on, Phil.
Hey, you know what would be funny, though? Is like, you know, they hear that and they give a little chuckle on it. And then one of them tries to pull it off like 3 days later and slightly mixed company. And he just doesn't have the personality for it.
I'm in the culture. What? All right, let's see. We ready for another? Did I have a secular answer to that one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. She said pump out a marriage proposal.
I'm hesitant on that. I mean, I get that it reflects where he's going to. I just wonder, like, this may be the wrong time to push it.
No, it's bold move time, Ben.
You're saying he's doubling down when he's got a weak hand is the problem.
I think he's doubling down when someone is, when she would take it as, she wouldn't see it as a strong ploy for her love. I think she would see it as an aggressive stance. If she is in a protection mode, the last thing you want to do is kind of puff up.
True.
So I think you stay the course for a while.
You live your life in fear. We just talked about this. Marriage. Hello, woman. We shall be one. Here we go.
You will be like dog who follows me around. Love, Dan.
This one seems to has the word cacophony in it.
Ooh.
So it might be a... Okay, here we go. Dear Life from the Path. After the long winters in Minnesota, we look forward to summer to open our windows and enjoy the fresh air. However, we are unable to do that because of wind chimes. Apparently, wind chime owners don't understand or care that the noise carries throughout the whole block, especially on windy nights. Please, folks, take down your chimes and hang up something quiet instead. You know, I have a hard time moving my feather wind chimes because they don't freaking do anything. And they're stupid.
What's the advice here?
It's just a call to everybody. Take down the wind chimes.
Yeah.
I'm not responsible. Considerate of your neighbors is what they're
Are
asking.
Are you serious?
No, I'm just saying that's what she's asking.
Oh, I mean, I thought you were proposing that wind chimes need to go.
This seems less like advice and more of a public service announcement.
Yeah.
From the anti-wind chimes society?
I want to say I have not purchased wind chimes. I've been tempted many times.
That's right.
Wait, you've had moments of hesitation while picking up a set of wind chimes?
I'm looking at those would be some nice wind chimes. I'm thinking, the neighbors don't need to hear that. I could put them in my house and put a fan on it or something. But
they're actually not allowed at our apartment.
There you go.
Preschool Dan with the oscillating fan. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. Oh.
It's a little bit redneck, Dan. put an oscillating fan on some wind chimes in your place.
Well, that doesn't annoy anybody else that way.
That's the way to solve a problem that did not exist at all.
Yeah. People don't create irritating noises. Wind chimes do.
I don't think I've ever, like, sat in my bed at night and been, like, horsed off because there's a guy rocking wind chimes somewhere.
That's true. You're walking down the block and you're like, I can't believe this.
This is an outrage.
They're so soothing.
No respect.
We're forming a committee.
What has society come through? The church has done this.
That's right. This is one of the sins the church is okay with. Wind chimes.
Noise pollution.
Hey, here's the deal. I kind of like those ones made out of wood, though. The metal ones are a little bit annoying, but like
bamboo
Arabian Peninsula ones.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're cool.
I wind chimes give storms some atmosphere.
Yeah.
Well, that's how you know they're coming.
I know. It makes it more ominous. It seems like something big is going to... It's like the start of the Twister movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so basically we're saying we have no support for this woman.
Well, we kind of like the sound of wind chimes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We're pro wind chime here. Yeah. Maybe that's what happens when you get to Minnesota. People hate wind chimes.
Boy, that's tough. I don't know. I'm trying to find a way to sympathize here. I'm really having trouble.
Probably because we're all Iowans and we have to listen to locusts all week.
True.
So we're like, we just like those, like, you know.
We like random noises coming from the outside.
A more pleasant sound.
In fact, when it's very quiet outside, you get very suspicious. Like, what's happening?
There's
either a tornado coming or the place blew up.
And I like the thought that, like, you do feel that way. When stuff's quiet, we automatically think something nefarious is afoot. And I like the thought that there's a criminal sitting somewhere who's waiting until all the noise dies down before he creeps the streets.
Well, cut down all the wind chimes so you can break in.
Now that's genius, right? Like, you could probably burglarize an entire neighborhood by hanging wind chimes everywhere and letting it cover up your breaking activities.
Wait, is it true, though? Like, do Iowans have like sound machines? Is that not widely regarded? Because it sounds like you're right, though. Like I don't you get used to locusts and breezes and chimes and stuff. And is there pockets of Minnesota where they don't tolerate sleep noises?
It seems like this pocket apparently does tolerate wind chimes, and here we like our locusts. And maybe in New York they like car horns. I don't know. Maybe
I assume people that are like me are normal, and people that are not like me are abnormal. Is that not the right way to look at the world?
No, we all look at the world that way. There's either Ben or there's everything else.
Yeah. And this wind chime lady has stepped outside of her purview.
Aren't you driving a 98 Blazer? Well, you're a real freak of nature.
I don't know how you even got in this country. Oh, you're a churchgoer, you say? Absolutely not. All right, here we go. Secular's advice, or basically, she didn't even ask for advice. It says, if your solution to this problem is writing to me, hoping your neighbors will see your letter, please allow me to offer a better one. Bake a batch of cookies, or another confection, and take it to these neighbors. When you hand your gift to them, explain that their wind chimes are driving you and some of the other neighbors to distraction. Then ask if they would please be kind enough to take them down and suggest that perhaps they hang a basket of flowers in their place.
I feel like the cookies are a little dishonest here.
Yeah!
And transparently.
Other neighbors, too.
Yeah, exactly.
People are talking.
You've bloviated a story. You've done exactly what we talked about not doing. You're not living an integrity-driven life. If this was actually a problem for me, I can't imagine that I couldn't walk up to my neighbor and say, hey, man, those wind chimes drive me bonkers. How do you listen to them at your place all the time? Like, I would have to sympathize and see, like, hey, do you have a hearing problem? Or, I mean, if it was enough to drive me insane, I feel like we could have a regular conversation apart from baking cookies and be like, hey, we don't really know each other very well, and I secretly hate you because you're wind chime. But here's some cookies. Can we talk about your wind chime? Like that?
Earn your trust.
Yeah, that's right. Nothing says trust like suspicious cookies.
Or better yet, hold the cookies back. Let them smell them and say, hey, if you take down those wind chimes, I got some cookies for you. Yeah.
How are you with the American art of blackmail?
You've been listening to Live from the Path. It's more of a bribe.
What did I say?
You don't know the distinctions of nefarious deeds. you've been listening to Live from the Path. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you're on the Truth Network 99.3, we can only afford so much time, so we've got to let you go. If you're hanging out on the podcast, we will be right back with you. Here's the deal. Be faithful in the means. God will take care of the ends. Thanks for listening to Live from the Path. I don't know why people can't solve problems just by saying, hey, man, I'm running into a problem.
Yeah, here's the deal. Here's the honest take on the situation.
I would feel guilty about bringing the cookies. I would have to bring the cookies and then bring them back a couple, like, talk about the chimes two weeks later to make sure it didn't feel like I was trying to buy their agreement. Because here's the deal. All you're encouraging, let's say he takes them. Now you know your neighbor's fickle. Maybe the guy next door on the other side loves wind chimes and brings over some brownie bites or something.
Yeah.
And now he's bought the wind chimes back in, and you're some sort of dessert war with your neighborhood.
And nobody wins there.
Except for the fat guy in the middle who's got all these desserts and the wind chimes. All right.
Actually, if I thought that was the case, I'd put up a bunch of wind chimes just to try to get people to bring me free cookies.
Yeah.
Like, I would purposely do irritating things that make my neighbors try to buy me out. Here we go.
Actually, wasn't that something that P.T. Barnum did? He would set up a circus, and then he would hire a really crappy band somewhere else in town that would drive people away, like away from where they were at to where the circus was. I think I remember reading about that. That was like a P.T. Barnum deal. You put something junky somewhere else, and so people decided to go to the circus.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it is. I'm starting my own agency.
Hey, we need to recruit for an even more lame radio program.
I got a guy in mind.
To go on before us.
Yeah.
That's kind of the whole lion approach, you know, the male lion roars and scares all the game into the pack of women lions, and then they eat him.
See, that's what you can do in retirement.
Get a lion?
I'm not sure where I was going with that.
Scare the neighborhood kids into the trenches.
Is the lion the star of your low-rent internet radio show?
No, I had some dudes in mind, but I feel like it would be gossipy to tell you their names right now.
That's fair.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's...
I have to verify they're lame and available.
All right.
Here we go. Dear Life from the Path. Recently, my husband was asked to be the best man at his friend's wedding. The happy couple did not have the financial means to hire a photographer, so I was asked to take pictures of the ceremony and reception. I'm not a professional photographer, and the bride knows that. I gladly photographed the nuptials on the couple's big day. Of course, I charged them nothing for doing it. I am now on the receiving end of insulting comments regarding the photos I took. When the bride rudely voiced her displeasure, I was taken aback. I did nothing less than my very best to accommodate her, and I have received nothing but ingratitude and disrespect for my efforts. I believe in keeping commitments I have made. I intend to complete the edits of the original photos and create a wedding album as I promised. However, how do I tactfully address the situation with the bride if she reminds me again of my lack of professional photography skills?
Let her finish the project.
You think it's time to bail?
It might be.
Or, you know, finish it and wrap it up in some nice little paper that says that you get what you pay for.
You're in charge of Dan.
Yeah. She's doesn't want to lie. She's going to fulfill her obligation. And the other gal is being ungrateful. It's like, well, you didn't, you know, you get what you pay for. You didn't hire a professional. You asked me to do it for free. I'm doing it. I did it.
I guess
what you get.
Decide why you're doing this. Are you doing this for you or are you doing this for the bride? If it's for the bride, then it sounds like you're done. If it's for you, then go ahead and finish.
Okay. I think I can jump on that wagon, right?
Yeah. I mean, here's the deal. I don't know that there's anything that you're going to say or do at this point that's going to substantially change her mind, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think what would sound rational to me is I turn over the pictures and say, you know, I think you might get more of what you're looking for if you here's the raw pictures. If you have someone kind of professionally work on them, just like kind of the base photography, this isn't my skill area. And I think to get the most out of what you're looking for, here's what I would do. So here's all the pictures. Mm-hmm. I hope you find someone that can you know,
here's
work
a list
with
of professionals.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and like, there's a way to do that without being insulting. But the truth is that like, you're not going to be vindicated here. Mm-hmm. No. I mean, you got to know what you're walking into. You're not going to be vindicated. She's obviously thinking about this irrationally. She's probably going to come to terms with it after this, the emotion of her wedding comes and goes. And like that day becomes less important. Like her marriage is important. That day becomes less. And it's probably all going to be fine. And so I think you have to kind of just chalk that up with knowing that she's acting improperly, but there's no reason to meet her there, just kind of like the husband and wife experience. There's no reason to amp up and try to convince her. Just hand her the stuff, say, I think you're going to, you know, you might have some success with someone who's got some better skills at this than I am. I'm sorry I couldn't produce what it is that you were looking for. I think that seems completely fair.
Yeah.
Realistically, they're only going to need one good picture of the two of them, and that's about it. You know, a year from now, that's all they really need for their wedding album. They'll just take one, make it an 8x10, stick it somewhere in their house, and that's the picture that they're going to keep.
Yeah.
So they can, at this point, go hire a photographer, go out to some location somewhere, and just get a picture of the two of them.
How am I going to get Uncle Brad doing the keg stand? Again, he's not going to recreate
that. That's not the good picture that they want. They want the picture of just the two of them in their wedding clothes. Okay, go out to Ledges or somewhere and get a picture of that.
Yeah, that's true. Stage photography is overrated anyway.
Yeah.
It was staged when it happened. It's not like you captured a moment. You stood there for a moment while I took a picture. Yeah. There's no reason you can't do that after the wedding.
No.
Oh, we should have done that.
You're cheapening it.
In fact, a lot of people do pictures after the wedding. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They continue to do the photographs and stuff. And it's like, you know, it's a staged photo. Let's take it for what it is. If, like, I can never recreate that moment again. You staged it to begin with. I feel like just put the same things in place.
How did you become this way?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm callous about it.
I had a bad experience.
Our wedding pictures were a disaster. We actually had Cheryl's, my wife's dad, who was a professional photographer, do them. But it's like, not only was it his daughter getting married, but he was also in the middle of a divorce. He was not mentally in a place. And the other guy was like showing up at the wedding, and there was a big battle going on. He was not in a place. And so like something was wrong with the camera, and like we have like no pictures, you know, like maybe two and maybe some snapshots from grandma type of thing.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it's like it was disappointing, but we're like, well, we should have hired someone then. You know, we weren't mad at him. We weren't like, we certainly didn't
degrade him.
Have
you ever done something for free from somebody and they, and like just to be nice and they hated it? or it went really, really bad?
I think most things I do.
Most of
them. I disappoint a lot of people.
I have a very long list of people that are upset with me.
I have had the experience of agreeing to someone who said they would help me out on a project, and they didn't do a very good job, and I wasn't very happy with it. But like, it was actually an illustration. I wrote a kid's book, and someone had volunteered to kind of do some of the illustrations, and I thought, oh yeah, that's cool, because like I can't do anything. And so they did it, and I didn't care for them. Like I don't think it fit very well. But like I didn't blame them. Like they just did what they did. That was their output, and that's on me. Either A, because I just didn't care for it, and it's not really necessarily their problem. I just didn't care for it, or I didn't do a good enough job of kind of vetting some stuff out to make sure that I had given them the best chance to be successful. Right? Like if you bring the wrong person in to do something they're not qualified to do, how can you reasonably be upset with them when they do what they do? Mm-hmm. That's not fair. And so I remember I wasn't very happy with that, but I was more disappointed myself because I felt bad because I let this person do some of these things, and like I wasn't actually very mindful of them and what that reality, that circumstance was going to be for them. And I felt bad about that. I thought I could have done a better job making sure that I didn't put them in a position where it was possible they wouldn't succeed or that they would have a bad experience. And like that was actually on me.
Yeah,
that was my fault, and I learned my lesson from that. I've done a better job of even people that are willing to help and say I want to be helpful. I'm responsible for being discerning in that circumstance and saying, hey, you know, figuring out to make sure that's actually the right fit for them, so I don't set them up for a bad circumstance that I could have done something about.
I've had this happen to me quite a bit. Like I will offer to go help someone do some electrical work or something at their house, and like it sounds like it's going to be an easy deal. They just don't know that much about it. And you're like, well, I'll just come over and help. It's no big deal. It should take a couple hours. And it turns into like a three-day nightmare. You broke something. You put a hole in something. Now you got to call a guy. And you're like, I need you to help me fix. And like it just – and they were – now they're irritated. They're like, I thought you said this was going to take 2 hours. And you're like, oh, man, how did I even get involved in this? You know, I should have just shut my stupid mouth. And like it's funny, but like a lot of those – it happens all the time. Like it just seems to happen over and over and over again, almost to the point where you want to callous up and say, look, I'm just not going to do it anymore. It's just not worth the hassle, you know? But like, I still keep saying yes. Yeah, I'll come over and help. Shouldn't be any big. My time frames are always like, yeah, it should take an hour or so. Really, it takes 6 hours, you know? And you end up in an attic somewhere, you know, it's 150 degrees outside. You're like, why did I could have said no. I could have just said no. People can pay for things, you know?
Exactly.
That was ridiculous. Anyway, here's what Segular says. It says, alas, it seems that no good deed goes unpunished. The next time the bride reminds you, all you have to do is suggest that for the next happy occasion, she spend some money and hire a professional instead of hitting up a friend for a freebie and then complaining about the result. Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah?
I don't know. Like the person that I would want to be, the answer would be, look, sometimes you just got to love people even when they are unlovable. And just muscle through it, right? You said you'd do it, produce the thing, give it to her, and try not to let her poor attitude sink into you and let you turn out to be a disgruntled person. You know, you're better off just letting it slide. All right, you want to do one more, Ben?
Yeah, let's do one more.
Okay, here we go. Dear Life from the Path, I have a friend, Riley, who is the sweetest woman I know. She's in her mid-20s and has a stable job. I wonder if she works at a farm. That'd be funny. Stable job's funny. Cancel. No one likes me. I get it.
Prairie Meadows.
She rescues animals that are terminal or nearly so. She's great with them and should become a veterinarian. Apparently not. All of her animals die around her. A few she has brought back to health, but others just can't be saved. My concern is that when Riley loses one, she breaks down. She cries for hours on end, but the minute she gets a call, she willingly takes in another one. She's like a sister to me, and I respect and admire her determination to care for these creatures and give them love when no one else will. How can I nicely say to her that I think she shouldn't accept any more rescues because she will only continue to get more depressed? Huh. What is...
I'm going to blank here.
Yeah.
Let her do it.
I mean...
That's her thing.
Yeah, man.
It seems like a weird place to insert yourself, right? Like, I see the way you're living your life. I hate it. Stop everything.
Let's have a burger.
Actually, I had a weird circumstance. Like, on my day job, I write correspondence, and I had put a phrase in a letter somewhere, and someone came up to me after having looked at this letter, and they said, hey, you know that phrase you put in there? Like, then they gave it to me. I said, yeah, and they go, I hate it. I'm like, well, that seems like a little dramatic, doesn't it? Like, you hate it? You
really? Sometimes I react poorly to correspondents.
And they're like, yeah, and I talk to so-and-so, and they hate it, too. I'm like, well, this seems really, you're really invested. I just didn't see that coming. I wish I cared a lot about what you were saying. I actually think it's all right, so I feel like it's going to stay, but I feel like you need to get a hobby or something. You're way too invested in that sentence.
Do you guys get the feeling that this man wants to date this lady?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's a guy?
I'm such a dullard, I didn't catch it at all.
I guess I thought they were with girls or something.
Okay, me and Dan don't
Okay, it doesn't say either way. It doesn't say whether it's a man or a woman, but I feel like... Hold on. I feel like every bit of this letter is, I love this woman.
Yeah.
And I don't like to see her hurt.
Yeah, this is a close friend.
That's exactly what I caught from it. I mean, she obviously has a coping mechanism for when an animal dies. Is she cries her eyes out and then she gets over it.
And that's not inherently bad.
Yeah.
Right? When an animal dies, works. Go ahead, shed a tear. No,
it's a
sad time.
Yeah, crying is a natural way. It's like preparing you for a life without the thing that you've lost. Like, it's... Mm-hmm. If you were a callous dude that looked at him like, all's well that ends well, and move on, I feel like that's a problem.
Yeah.
One more prop for beanbags. I mean, you're a bad person.
Can you make leather out of giraffe?
Yeah. You should be more concerned if she was not crying, right? If she was literally taking terminally ill animals in, watching them pass away, and then by bringing more into her internment camp. Like, that's just a creepy existence, yeah, right? Like,
that's when you write the letter.
That's right. We need to talk.
If she went into like a fugue and did beat poetry every 2 months after an animal died, I feel like you have a protest.
Yeah.
Other than that, she's dealing with it in a normal, healthy way. Move on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She's trying to prevent it from dying. That means she saves some. There are some successes, I'm guessing.
Yeah,
you know, I mean,
are you going to take down the whole, you know, retirement home healthcare facility?
You got to stop being a hospice worker. You're just so sad all the time.
This is futile, man. Get out.
Everybody that comes in here dies. Everybody.
Hey, that's not funny. But, I mean, it is true, right? Like, it put
there's
it
a high turnover that. I used to go to a lot of meetings. I was a chaplain for years. And it's so weird when success is death, but you're sad.
Yeah.
I mean, not success like we killed, you know, but,
right,
like,
but you helped
let
them
go peacefully, you know, and it's just like, we lost one. Yeah, you know, I mean, it's a weird, that's sorting through emotions right there.
Yeah, now to actually, I mean, to be fair, that is a different lifestyle that is not everyone is built for.
Yeah. They can't do it long.
Like, I couldn't work in a hospice. That is, there's a very, I mean, not only to the person that's in the hospice, but like their family, like some heavy situations going on there, man.
I listened to, like, one This American Life episode of that, and I couldn't make it through it.
That's what I'm saying.
I was trying to wire up lights at work, just hiding my tears. Like, this is too much.
Look somewhere else. Yeah. I got to go to the
party. Somebody write a letter about me. I can't handle this.
I'm falling apart here.
I wrote the following, and I hate it.
That's what I love about when we do our Christmas caroling pathway. We'll always go to the Mercy Hospice place.
Yeah.
And sometimes a family member will come up and sing. And you know this is the last time these people will hear, you know, Christmas carols.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just a deep, meaningful, wonderful, sad.
It's pretty emotional. I have trouble, like, when we do that Christmas carols thing, just kind of keeping it together. Because, like, you're right. Not only is that it's a very limited situation, and you're right, they're not going to hear it again. But even though in these moments of pain, you find that the families will come up and they'll sing along and, like, they'll be excited. And then they're smiling and they're crying. And it's just... Yeah. It's just a lot of things that are being processed kind of in that moment. It's a very cool thing.
You know, it's stuff like that that, like, I don't know, sometimes it just opens it like a peek to what living a little bit outside your normal life can be. You know what I'm saying? Like, actually investing in people, investing into what they're doing, and just getting involved with other people's lives around you. Like, there's so much going on and so much of the, like, you callous yourself to a very... stuck existence, you know, like I do this, I don't want to get involved over here because it could burn me, I don't want to get involved over here because I, you know, I might get hurt or that seems like really heavy and annoying and whatever, and like, man, involved in some of that stuff, you're missing some of the joy, you know, like you're missing some of the joy of people that have stories to tell and interactions to have, and like, I mean, God's given you some of that as a gift, and granted, there are some burdens that come with it. But like, there is inherently some joy in there that you're missing out of because you're a coward, because you're too afraid to get involved in people's lives.
Mike, build it. You gotta have joy because you're a coward.
I'm just saying, like, it's the truth. Half the things I don't get involved with is because I'm scared to death they're gonna take over every minute. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And like it's easier for me to sit in my calloused room and go, It's the same reason that I had a hard time getting involved with some of the homeless stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like I knew as soon as I went down there that I'd be in, that I'd see what's going on and be like, it was easier for me when I did not come down here. Mm-hmm. Now it's not near as easy. Yeah. Now it's not easy for me to drive with two casseroles right by and act like it ain't no deal. You know, or when backpacks are on sale for like $3, you're like, I know some fellas that can use some backpacks,
yeah.
You know? And like, it just, it makes it completely different. And like, while it seems easier at the time to not get involved with any of that stuff, like, man, you're just missing out on so much joy by saying no every time. Let's talk more about my wisdom. Secular says. Secular says, there's no nice way to say that to your friend. What you can say is that you are concerned about her because of the depression she experiences when she can't save one of her animals. For an animal lover, the loss of a pet is painful and personal, and her reaction is not unusual.
Okay, I'm going to agree on that.
Yep, that wasn't near as heartfelt and awesome as I'd say that we had.
No, I mean, it was short of the send it home cowardly thing at the end there. Dear Abby never pays off the way you want.
Yeah, I mean, that's too long to put on a bumper sticker, but I'll save up money. Maybe a Pinto will let me do it.
You don't invest in people because you're a coward. Love my bumper.
All right, you've been listening live from the Path. Thanks for hanging out with us tonight. Always a good time. We very much appreciate you listening. If you are on the podcast, which means you're already signed up, I appreciate that. If you want to see clips of the show, video stuff, make sure you go to lifeinthepath.org. We got past clips, past musical performances. There's stuff from Foreverland out there. We got the Driven 11 stuff. I at least got one of his things posted. Lots of cool guys coming through the show.
Yeah.
So very excited about that. Make sure you check that stuff out. Give those guys some love. Art is very difficult when people aren't when you don't have the ability. It's like love, right? Like when people aren't reacting to it, it's hard to continue to press on that. So if you got some time to show them some love, say hello, follow them on Facebook, that kind of stuff, please do that. Big thanks to Brandon. Hey man, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh yeah,
I appreciate it. Lots of good conversation tonight. If you have anything that you think is interesting for us, shoot us an email at info@livefromthepath.org. If you have complaints upon the show, you are a wise and discerning person, but I probably won't read them. Send them to Chris Roloff at the Truth Network 99.3 FM. He's the guy that's responsible for this ragtag affair being on the air. Thank you so much for listening to Live from the Path. Be faithful in the means, and God will take care of the ends. We'll see you next week.